Many college students in Iowa have been and will be walking across stages to pick up their diplomas this month. Today, I'll talk with two remarkable women who've been asked to send some of them off with words of wisdom. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Spoken word poet Sarah Kay has wowed audiences with her poem, Bee, written for a future daughter.
And she's gonna learn that this life will hit you hard, in the face, wait for you to get back up just so it can kick you in the stomach. But getting the wind knocked out of you is the only way to remind your lungs how much they like the taste of air.
She'll be speaking at the Grinnell College commencement on Monday, and I'll also talk with Sister Barbara Moore, who spoke at St. Ambrose University last weekend. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm going to talk to two remarkable women who've been invited to speak at commencement ceremonies in Iowa this spring. We also want to know what words of wisdom you wish you could share with this year's crop of graduates. What was the best piece of advice you got when you graduated from college? What piece of advice do you wish you had gotten when you graduated from college? We'll be collecting your advice on Twitter at IPR Talk and also on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. So sum it up in one sentence, your very best piece of advice. And later in the hour, I'll talk with Sister Barbara Moore, who played an important role in the civil rights movement. She spoke at St. Ambrose University, their commencement ceremony in Davenport last weekend. But first with me is spoken word poet Sarah Kay. She's been invited to give the commencement address at Grinnell College on Monday. She's been performing as a spoken word poet since she was 14 years old. She's the founder and co-director of Project Voice. She travels the world helping students find their voices. She's also a documentary filmmaker, playwright, singer, songwriter, and author. She grew up in New York City, and she's here now. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
The first thing that I think I need to mention, if people are not familiar with your work, if they haven't seen your TED Talk, which has been so incredibly popular, they may not know that you are only 24 years old, which seems like kind of a young age to be asked to be a commencement speaker at.
Indeed, yes.
Is this your first commencement that you've spoken at?
Absolutely, yeah.
What was your response when you were asked?
I was completely surprised, and actually I sent them back, I think, three times saying, are you sure that you're thinking of me? Am I the person that you are actually picking? For that reason, I didn't know if they knew that I was 24 years old.
Very close in age to many of the people who will be walking across that stage.
Yeah, well, I think that must be some part of what they're looking for. Obviously, it's a pretty bold choice to pick someone who's 24, but I think, you know, when you have a commencement speaker who is significantly older than the graduates, then what they're looking for from them is perhaps more of, here's what I've learned in my time, here's some of the wisdom that I've garnered, here's, you know, all of the things you should know going forward. And I think by having someone who's not so far ahead, I imagine they're looking for someone to say, like, look, I made it out. I'm still here.
Let's talk about your personal journey. You discovered poetry at a very young age and spoken word poetry also at a very young age. But as you were growing up, can you tell me what kind of role poetry played in your life?
Yeah, I've always loved poetry. And when I was very, very little, it was a game of playing with words that I loved, and I would chase my mother around the house and yell poem and make her write poems down for me before I knew how to write myself. So poetry has been a part of my life since I was a baby. And then when I was in school, my parents would do this thing, which I love and I talk about to this day, which is from kindergarten through fourth grade. Every single day, I would take my lunch to school, and either my mother or my father would write a little poem on a piece of paper and fold it up and put it in my lunchbox so that when I got to lunch every day, I would open up my lunchbox and have a poem. And I think that more than anything probably affected the way that I I feel about poetry, which is that it's something I'm expecting, but is also something that is a surprise. It brings me joy. It's a little piece of my day that's important to me, et cetera, et cetera. And that's probably the what shaped the most of how I react to poetry now. And then when I was 14, I was accidentally signed up for what's called a poetry slam, which is a competition for spoken word poetry specifically. And it was open to teenagers in New York City, and someone had registered me for it without my knowing. And to this day, we don't know who signed me up for that event. So I call it divine intervention, but the world will never know.
No one ever came forward
and
said, hey, I did that?
Forward. Yeah, you'd think that at this point, someone might have come forward, but
right.
They haven't. So because I loved poetry, I was 14, and I thought, sure, why not? That sounds cool. I tried it one time, and then I fell in love with it, and I just kept coming back.
Are your parents writers?
I think they are, but I don't think that they would call themselves that. My parents are both incredibly creative. My father is a photographer, and my mother is a photographer too, although less, professionally, I guess. But so both of them are visual artists, and they both see the world through a photographic lens. And actually, I believe that I write poetry the way that my parents photograph, that their photographic eye is what taught me how to see the world, and that's how I interpret the world into poetry.
What was it about spoken word poetry, do you think, that captured you so much when you were 14?
Oh, well, the first time that I ever performed spoken poetry was also kind of the first time I'd ever performed anything, really. I had been in piano recitals or things like that, but never me by myself on a stage speaking. That was not something that I was familiar with or terribly interested in. I was very anxious and nervous and not excited about being on a stage. But because I had been signed up for this, I went for it. And the actual act of doing the poem was terrifying and was not something that I particularly enjoyed. But afterwards, after I was done performing the poem, there was another teenager in the audience. And there was a lot of teenagers in the audience. There's 100 teenagers in the audience, but one teenager in particular was a girl who was about 3 years older than I was and came over and tapped me on the shoulder and looked me dead in the eyes and said, hey, I really felt that. And at age 14, I had never had that kind of experience before. I had never had a stranger approach me and tell me that they had found some kind of truth in something that I had created. And that was such a powerful moment. But that's really what made me fall in love with it and made me continue to want to do it. When you're 14, it's very rare that you have an opportunity to speak the things that are most important to you and have a room full of people who will listen. And that was such an addictive quality when I was 14, that that's really what made me continue to do it. Now that I'm older, the attraction of the art form is less about just finding people to listen to me, although that's still obviously a huge gift and a huge part of it that I value very much. But certainly when I was younger, just the fact that it was this message from the universe that I could participate and that I had value, and that my stories mattered. And that was so important for me at that age.
Would you perform a poem for us now?
Sure. I've been rushing around like a crazy person. I calculated last night, or actually 2 nights ago, was the first time I was able to sleep in my own bed since November, because I've been on the road traveling and touring and working at schools. And it was such a gift to be able to wake up in my own bed. And I've been thinking a lot about what it means to be busy and people who are really busy. So I thought I would do a poem about that. It's called Astronaut. I see the moon. The moon sees me. The moon sees somebody that I don't see. God bless the moon, and God bless me, and God bless the somebody that I don't see. If I get to heaven before you do, I'll write your name and pull you through. I'll write your name on every star, and that way the world won't seem so far. The astronaut will not be at work today. He has called in sick. He has turned off his cell phone, his laptop, his pager, his alarm clock. There is a fat yellow cat asleep on his couch, raindrops against the window, and not even the hint of coffee in the kitchen air. Everybody is in a tizzy. The engineers on the 15th floor have stopped working on their particle machine. The anti-gravity room is leaking, and even the freckled kid with glasses, whose only job is to take out the trash, is nervous. Spills a banana peel on a paper cup nobody notices. They are too busy recalculating what this will mean for lost time, how many galaxies are disappearing per second, how long before the next rocket can be launched somewhere. An electron flies off its energy cloud. A black hole has erupted. A mother finishes setting the table for dinner. A law and order marathon is starting. The astronaut is asleep. He has forgotten to turn off his watch, which ticks like a metal pulse against his wrist. He does not hear it. He dreams of coral reefs and plankton. His fingers find the pillowcase's sailing masts. He turns on his side, opens his eyes once. He thinks that scuba divers must have the most wonderful job in the world. So much water to glide through.
Sarah Kay performing her poem, Astronaut. And Sarah, I wanted you to do that not just because it's beautiful, but also so people can understand what it is that you do, because I think a lot of us have assumptions and ideas about poetry slams and what spoken word poetry must be like. But it strikes me that you have really made it your own.
Well, I think, you know, I was really lucky to grow up in New York City, and therefore there was already an existing spoken word poetry community and art scene that was going on when I was young and when I was reaching out for this form. And I discovered this community of poets who were creating and sharing their art. And really, for 4 years of my life, all through high school, I would listen a lot. And I was a sponge, and I just soaked up every single spoken word performance poet that I possibly could. And there were definitely, I'm sure, that you can find traces of other poets in my early work, because that's what happens when you're a young artist. You find the one that you love, and you follow them, and you sound like them, and that's how it works. And then over time, hopefully, you keep finding more and more and more, and slowly something that sounds more like you starts coming out.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll talk more about this in a moment. I'm talking with spoken word poet Sarah Kay. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking to two remarkable women who have come to Iowa or are coming to Iowa to be part of commencement ceremonies. Coming up in a little while, I'll talk with Sister Barbara Moore, who played an important role in the civil rights movement. She spoke at the St. Ambrose University commencement ceremony in Davenport last weekend. My guest right now is spoken word poet Sarah Kay, and she will be speaking at the Grinnell College commencement ceremony on Monday. And Sarah, just before the break, we were talking about how you saw so many, listened to so many, talked to so many other spoken word poets and really absorbed things from each of them. You had been writing poetry as a kid for quite a while. What is the difference for you between writing a poem for performance and writing a poem for the for paper?
That's a great question. Have you ever had the experience of reading a book, and you're reading the book and you think, oh, this is such a great book, but I kind of wish it was a movie, right?
Yes.
That's a terrible feeling. Uh-huh. Nobody wants that feeling. It's so much better when you're reading a book and you think, oh, this is such a great book, and it has to be a book. It would never work as a movie. It would never work as anything else other than this book. And I'm so happy that I'm reading it. There's something really satisfying about that. You know, nobody looks at a Picasso painting and goes, oh, that's nice, but I kind of wish it was a photograph. You know, it has to be the painting. And I think that for me, the difference between a poem that is a page poem and a poem that's a stage poem, at least the best kinds of stage, the best examples of stage poems, are you can tell when a poem that is being performed needs to be performed, when there is something in that poem that you would miss out on if you were reading it on a piece of paper. If there is some element of meaning that was created in the performance that is unseeable, that is invisible when you are reading it on a piece of paper. So that could be a number of things. It could be something you do with your voice, like singing or whispering or shouting or humming or beatboxing. It could be something you do with your facial expressions. If you wink at a line, if you make a face that we can't see on a piece of paper, it could be something you do with your hands, something you do with your body. When you're writing a poem, when I'm writing a poem that's for performance, I'm already thinking about what elements of performance can go into the craft of this poem so that when an audience is seeing it live, that there is some tiny part of their subconscious that knows, wow, I really had to be here.
When you start writing, do you know if it's a performance poem or a poem for paper?
That's a good question. Sometimes I know there's something I really want to share in a room full of people, and sometimes I don't know, and I'll write a poem that I think is just for the page, and then I'll look at it a little more, and I'll say, oh, maybe this is something that I could move off the page and adapt and change and edit a little bit more and have it be ready for a stage, or vice versa. Sometimes I write a poem for the stage and I perform it one time and I go, oh, you know what? I actually don't really want to put this out in front of people for whatever reason. And I'm happy to let it sit on the page instead. So sometimes, but sometimes no.
What does writing poetry do for you?
I tell people that I write poetry when I have something I'm trying to figure out. That the act of writing a poem is an act of navigating or an act of puzzling, not necessarily puzzle solving, because I don't think it's necessarily true that I'll finish a poem and finally understand what it was I was trying to figure out, although sometimes that happens. It's more the act of poem writing is me sorting through things, is me trying to understand whatever it is I'm confused about or wondering about.
I spoke with the poet Cornelius Eady not very long ago, and we were reflecting on his early career and something that he's come back to now at this point, much later in his career. And we were talking about teenage poetry, and I wrote a bunch of teenage poetry. And when I look back on that poetry, I'm not particularly proud of it. I'm a little embarrassed by some of it. Now, you're only 24 years old, and clearly you are performing poems, writing poems that are really touching people of all ages. But do you have a stash of poetry from when you were 14 or 13 where you look at it and say, oh my gosh, I can't believe I was ever that young?
Of course. I have stacks of poems from last week that I say, oh my gosh, I can't believe I was ever that young. I think that one of the things that I love about this poetry, and one of the things that I try very hard to do for myself, is to not get ahead of myself when I'm writing. I don't try to write a poem that sounds like I'm 40, because I'm not. I try to write a poem that sounds like I'm 24, because I am. And what's neat is that now I've been doing this for 10 years of my life. So I have poems that I wrote when I was 14 that sound like I was 14. And I have poems that I wrote when I was 20 that sound like I'm 20. And I'm okay with that. And I like having those. And I don't go back and edit them later to make them sound more grown up. Because in a certain way, it's as if I built a little landmark to what it feels like to be there. Especially because poetry is about what I'm trying to figure out. So it's very much a little landmark to say, oh, wow, this is what I was trying to figure out when I was 14. And so some of those poems I look back at and go, wow, you know what? I still haven't figured that out. I'm still working on that thing that I wrote about when I was 14. Or I look at a poem and I go, wow, yeah, that's what I was worried about, and I'm not worried about it anymore. Or that's what I was thinking about, and I've figured it out. So I kind of like having those poems to revisit and return to. Some of them I don't perform anymore, and then some of them I do perform, and the performance of them is totally different. The words are the same, but my relationship to the words are completely different, and I think you can tell that in the performance.
Does it make you, in some ways, hungry for life experiences? I think about, you know, having your first broken heart. Obviously, that's something that changes you, and it gives you a kind of depth of perception that somebody who's never had their heart broken just doesn't have. Does it make you almost eager for those experiences so that you can write about them?
I don't think anybody is eager for a broken heart, but I think I'm lucky that I have learned from my parents, and I've learned from friends, and I've learned from a long list of amazing poets of how to celebrate. And I think, to me, the act of writing a poem is an act of celebration, even if you're writing a poem about heartbreak, even if you're writing a poem that's angry. Part of that writing of the poem is a celebration of that feeling, or a celebration of that moment, or a celebration of you figuring this out and feeling a certain way and ready to share it. And I really see that as a celebration, and I think about it as a celebration. And so maybe that is more what I would say. It's not so much that I'm eager to have my heart broken, but then when I find myself writing about something that is difficult or frustrating or infuriating even, that there is a part of me that recognizes that as horrible as this may feel, or as frustrating as it may be, that I, celebrating it, you are giving it its time and its due, and recognizing it as important and valid as an experience.
I think the poem that you're most famous for is called "Be," and it's one that you performed in the TED Talk speech that has been shared so many times on YouTube that if you haven't seen it, you should go watch it because it's really amazing. And you also turned it into a book. And this is a poem that you write about having a daughter someday in the future and what you will do when you have this daughter. And it's a poem that has resonated with so many, I'm sure, daughters and mothers and sisters and people who have listened to it. But when I was listening to it, I couldn't help but think how different it will sound to you someday when you have a daughter. Do you think about and have you experienced that shift with some of your poetry?
Yeah, certainly. I think that sort of falls into the earlier question about writing poems when you're young and then looking back at them and cringing with your youth. Certainly, there are parts of B that come from a place where I was really young. I don't think I believe in the poem any less. I think that now I just have addendums that I want to add. And I think I will continue to find those addendums. And rather than try to doctor that poem or, you know, discredit it, I think I like the fact that there is a youthful optimism and naivety to it, and that then I just have more poems to write about the other aspects that I didn't fully understand at the time that I wrote that one.
Is it tempting? I know that with artists who paint, often there's this temptation to go back and change things about something that they have already said they have finished, but then they see something and they want to make it different. And George Lucas is another example of how somebody returns to their art and wants to change it. Do you have that temptation to change the poetry?
I don't think so. I think I take that temptation and I turn it into needing to write a new poem. And I think that, you know, it's even more interesting if I'm doing a performance instead of changing the poem and having it be, for whatever reason, I think more correct or more timely or more wise. Instead of doing that, how exciting would it be to see the old poem and then have me say, this is what I've been thinking about, and here's how I've changed, and here's what the new poem sounds like, so that an audience can see more visibly the process that happened and the growth of person that occurred from one poem to the next. I think that's really interesting to see, rather than doctoring something to try to make it prettier.
I want to talk about your work with Project Voice, and you are the founder and co-director of Project Voice, and it takes you all over the world to work with students, right?
Yes, yes. I am the co-director. There's another guy who runs it with me named Phil Kay, and together we have created this organization that is dedicated to using spoken word poetry as an education, literacy, and empowerment tool. And so we are performing it and teaching it in schools around the world, as young as kindergarten and all the way up through college, graduate school, and adult programs. And we've now been in hundreds of classrooms of every possible configuration, all girls, all boys, co-ed, private, public, independent, day school, boarding school, international, you name it, we've seen it. And it's great. And it's so exciting and such a blessing to get to do that kind of work. It's also the reason that I haven't gotten to sleep in my own bed since November.
I can imagine that it's so different to go into an elementary school classroom and talk about writing poetry and go into a classroom full of junior high students or something like that. Little kids tend to be uninhibited. But as we get older, those inhibitions kick in. What do you think is the most challenging age group to really get kids to open up and express?
Oh, the most challenging age group. That's a great question. It depends on so many factors other than age. It depends on, who the kids are and who they have been listening to in school, out of school, and what their preconceived notions around poetry, around writing, around performing, around self-expression, what they're holding back and what they're guarding. All of those things play into it. I will say that I think 9th and 10th graders are sometimes a challenge because they're just out of middle school, so they know that it's time to be a grown-up, but they just don't have it yet, and that's terrifying for them. And so there's a lot that they guard and a lot that they're scared of, and that's often a really big challenge. But it's also one of my favorite age groups to teach because of that reason, because they have so much. They're in this beautiful place of straddling childhood and adulthood, and no one else can talk about that the way that they can. So it's so exciting to me when they finally do, when they are ready to talk about it. They're giving the rest of us such a gift that we can't get anywhere else.
Can you give me an example of someone who was closed off, if you've helped to express themselves this way?
Let me see. I mean, I can tell you my favorite story of anything that's ever happened to me on a stage. I don't know if this is directly what you're looking for, but I think it fits that category of story. Phil and I were asked to perform at a small private Catholic school in Southern California, which was a really conservative school, and had a reputation for being pretty no-nonsense, and we were a little bit worried because besides the one person who had invited us, nobody else at the school had ever seen or heard of spoken word poetry before. And we can get a little goofy, and we try to have fun, and we were like, uh-oh, this might not go over so well. And we went to the school, and we performed, and it actually did go really well, and the students really loved it, and the teachers really loved it, and it was a middle school too, so it was a slightly younger age, but they were still really involved, and it was great, and we were so happy. And they liked it so much that a year later, they invited us back again to perform at the school a second time. And whenever Phil and I are performing at a school, we always take a section of time out of the performance to see if there's anybody in the audience that wants to come up on stage and perform a poem, mainly because we never know when there might already be a young poet in the audience who's been waiting for an opportunity like this. And the first time we were at the school, we asked, and nobody volunteered, which is completely understandable since they had never heard of or seen this art form before. But the second year when we came back, I asked whether there was anybody in the audience who wanted to come up and share a poem. And no sooner had I asked the question when this boy in the third row jumped up onto the stage. He didn't wait for me to call on him. He didn't raise his hand. He just jumped up onto the stage. And when he got there, he was out of breath. He was so excited. And I said, hey, buddy, what's your name? And he said, I wrote this poem the day after you left last year, and I have been waiting all year to share it with you.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's hard to beat a moment like that.
Yeah. So that's certainly one of the moments that I carry with me.
Is there, now that you're going to be speaking to a group of students graduating from college on Monday, is there a piece of advice that you wish someone had given you just a couple of years ago when you graduated?
I mean, there's all kinds of advice that I would love. I continue to need. I think a big one for me specifically when I was graduating is someone needing to tell me it's not a race, you know. It's not a race. Nothing is a race. It's your journey at your pace, doing whatever it is you are going to do is exactly what you're supposed to be doing. It doesn't matter what anybody else is doing. It really doesn't matter. And it's so hard to know. It's still so hard for me to know. It's still difficult to watch anyone else do anything and go, oh, man, maybe I should be doing that, or, oh, I'm behind, or whatever. It's constantly an anxiety. And I'm sure that's an anxiety for other people, especially, I think, in a career that is less certain in general, like the arts, for example.
Sarah, we are out of time. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Spoken word poet Sarah Kay, she will be speaking at the commencement ceremony at Grinnell College on Monday. And I do encourage you to go to YouTube and look up her TED Talk, Sarah Kay. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking to two remarkable women who have been invited to Iowa to speak at commencement ceremonies. I just finished talking to Sarah Kay, who will be at the Grinnell commencement ceremony. And with me now is Sister Barbara Moore. She was the commencement speaker at St. Ambrose University, which is located in Davenport, last weekend. She was asked to speak about her experiences in the civil rights movement. She's a founding member of the National Black Sisters Conference, and she went to Selma, Alabama in 1965 to march to Montgomery with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Sister Barbara Moore, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
And let's talk about your childhood first. And you were born in the South, right?
Yes. I was actually born in Memphis, Tennessee. My parents were living in Birmingham at the time, and my mother had relatives in Tennessee, so she went there just to have me. But I lived in Birmingham, Alabama, until I was six, and then we moved to St. Louis, Missouri.
And when you moved to St. Louis, racial relations were a little bit better in St. Louis, right?
Well, they were a little bit better, but the restaurants and hotels and schools were still segregated. And I remember one time going to a neighborhood theater with a friend of mine, and we were turned away because blacks were not welcome at a neighborhood theater.
Was that something that you talked about at home when you were growing up, how unfair these Jim Crow laws were?
Oh, yes. I grew up with the stories of my parents, aunts, and uncles who were all from Mississippi, and they shared their stories of Jim Crow and segregation, and we always heard about their experiences and how important it was for us to get our education and to always speak up and stand up for ourselves.
When you were growing up, your family converted to Catholicism. That was when you were in eighth grade?
Yes, it was the December of my eighth grade. And I had attended an all-segregated school. However, our teachers were excellent, and they expected us to excel. And upon graduating from elementary school, that was when I entered an all-girls Catholic high school, Rosati Kane at the time. And it was desegregated because Cardinal Ritter had desegregated all of the Catholic institutions years earlier. And so that school was open to us, although there weren't that many, I call people of color there, but I received a wonderful education. We had two orders of nuns there, the Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet, the order to which I now belong, and the School Sisters of Notre Dame. And I always laugh. I just enjoyed every day there and enjoyed being there in the sisters.
Was that part of the attraction of Catholicism for your family, the fact that you could go to a school that was desegregated? Was that part of the decision?
No. We grew up going to church every Sunday, Baptist tradition. But it was my mother who really became a convert to Catholicism. And then she invited me and my brother at the time to, she said, go take a look and see. And we looked and we saw, and we wanted to become Catholic as she had been converted. And that's when we, it had nothing to do with desegregation, but it had to do with the spirit and the experience and also the doctrine and the dogma. And we were welcomed. I remember the first Mass I ever attended. My brother and I, we were little children, and I think we were probably the only African-Americans in the group, and no one moved. We were welcomed, although in the history of the church, I do know that this has not always been so, but in St. Louis at the time, they were beginning to open up and to welcome people of color. However, all people were not happy with the decision that Cardinal Ritter had made. And I even say even some of the priests and sisters were not happy, you know, publicly. However, I certainly did not experience this from any of the teachers that I had. And the priests, I'd go to Teen Town and things like this, and it was always a lot of fun. And so I never experienced that overt racism in those situations.
When did you feel called to become a nun?
Well, I was very involved in Scouts from Brownies on up to Girl Scouts, and it was based at a center here in St. Louis that the Sisters of the Helpers of the Holy Souls ran. And so I was very involved in that. We'd go to all the services. I felt attracted. But the one thing that sealed it was during our senior year, we would take a visit to the Mother House for the School Sisters of Notre Dame and the Sisters of St. Joseph. And I had the opportunity to go to both. And I was so just really overjoyed by the exuberance. Our Mother House is up from the banks of the Mississippi in South St. Louis. And there were sisters who had just received their, we call it their habit at the time, in probably March 19th, the Feast of St. Joseph. And we were there probably in April or May. And they were so friendly and seemed so happy. And that was very moving to me. And also our religion instructor, a priest, he had recommended that we attend Mass every day during Lent to determine what God was calling us to. And I did that. I went to daily Mass, and then one day after that particular field trip, my homeroom teacher came, and she said, "Did you ever think of being a nun?" And I said, "Yes," and that led to other things, and, you know, never realizing that there were no other African-American sisters that had ever entered the congregation. But, you know, one thing led to the other, and I did enter in September of 1955.
And when you entered, did you know that you were the first African-American sister?
No, I didn't. I was just, I felt called by God, and I wanted to serve God and serve other people. I had no idea. And really, even when I got there, it just never, you know, dawned on me that I'm the only one. I mean, I knew I was the only one, obviously, after getting there. But, and I did not realize that there were not others in the congregation at the time.
I want to fast forward a little bit to 1965. I think we could talk for hours.
Yeah.
But in 1965, of course, people have all heard of the attempts to march from Selma to Montgomery with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And the first attempt took place on March 7th, 1965, and that is the day we know as Bloody Sunday. So clearly that was not a successful march. After that, a call was put out asking for members of the clergy and other people who were involved in religious orders to come and march. Do you remember when this idea was brought forth to you?
Yes, I do. And I do want to clarify one thing, that I did not actually march from Selma to Montgomery. We were there the weekend right after Bloody Sunday. And our province superior, we called it at the time, called me and said that she had been made aware that there was a delegation going from Kansas City, Missouri, to Selma, and did I want to go? And I said, well, yes. Had no idea what I was getting into, but I knew that people had not been able to vote, and of course, aware of Bloody Sunday, all of that was all over the TV with the hoses and dogs and people being beaten. And so there was a delegation of 22 of us, composed of priests, sisters of various different communities, usually in two. There was another sister from our community who went also, and then a Presbyterian minister and one of his parishioners who was African American. And so I had always, again, been taught to stand up for what I believed in, and this was one way that I felt I could stand in solidarity with those who were demonstrating and fighting for civil rights.
Were you scared?
It's funny. I was nervous, but I don't really remember being scared. And I always say, you know, being that it was the Holy Spirit was with us, although we had some serious situations. But when I returned home back to Kansas City was when I really realized what might have happened and fortunately did not happen. And that's when the real gravity of the situation hit me. So I was off 2 or 3 days, a nurse by profession, to have some time just to reflect on my experiences and to calm myself in that after such that was a profoundly moving experience for me, the whole thing. And so I'm deeply grateful for having had it, but scared probably was not, you know, the word, but I certainly was nervous. I'll leave it at that. Might not see any difference.
But before you actually would be making yourself vulnerable, I mean, you were told that you, being an African-American nun, were at greater risk than other nuns who had joined.
Right, and then they told the strategy in Brown Chapel, that was the place where the nonviolent, they call them lieutenants, they were talking about the strategy and how we were to conduct ourselves and what we were to do. And I mean, they were no nonsense. They were very direct, but just, and a lot of them were ministers. But they told the Presbyterian lady and me, now, you know, if you are arrested, you will not be put in the same place that the white sisters will be put in. And in light of that, do you still want to march? And we had to make that decision, and both of us said yes. But fortunately, we were not arrested at the time.
What kind of protest did you participate in?
Well, we actually marched from Brown Chapel to the Selma Courthouse. And we were told about linking our arms, and no matter what happened, we were not to retaliate or just remain with our arms linked, looking straight ahead. And one young man said, well, what if I just have to retaliate? And they said, you don't march. But we did actually march, and I experienced the state troopers in full riot gear, goggles, billy clubs, guns, and everything menacing. But I said, in looking at them, and really, I was on the front line of the group that we were in, and, you know, like face to face with them. And they seemed as nervous as we were, I'm sure, you know, in looking at the eyes. But we were able to continue to march to the courthouse that particular day.
You then went home, and as the final march took place, were you watching?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. In fact, there were some African-American physicians. They were aware that I had been there, and they said, now, if you would like to go back, we'll pay your way. But I thought I had made my contribution, and I declined. But, no, I certainly did watch the march and, you know, have seen that repeated several times.
Right. And you have been back to commemorate it as well, right?
35th and 40th anniversaries, as well as I've been back to Selma several times. We have sisters there who served in the community. We have a physician and two nurse practitioners and friends of mine. And so I've been back to visit with them. But the 35th and 40th anniversary celebrations were wonderful because, there were a lot of people from the movement. It was wonderful to see them and be among them, but the whole spirit was different, of course, because the state troopers were there to protect us and not to harm us.
Right, to aid you.
Yeah, and aid us. And part of that celebration, they had in each of the churches, they would have different speakers, and you could go hear whom you would like to. And then it always ended with walking across the Edmund Pettus Bridge.
Now, I think that probably there are not a lot of African-Americans in this country that take equality entirely for granted. But growing up today and having equal rights and equal access to education for the most part, it must be easy to take a little bit of it for granted. What would you like young people growing up today to know about what you experienced so that they can remember to be thankful for what they do have?
Well, it's not, it's not just what I experienced, but there were people from all parts of the country and black and white, young and old, different denominations who stood in solidarity for a cause. And people literally gave their lives that we could vote. And so I do not have too much patience with those for any reason who choose not to exercise their responsibility. And there are a lot of people who don't. And another is get your education. And part of that education is knowing your roots, our history in this country, because sadly to say, a lot of that still is not in textbooks. It's not being taught. And I always say, less we forget. So it's important to know the sacrifices that people have made, there's a lot of improvement. There's a lot that needs to continue to improve, in my opinion. But there are people who've given their lives and great sacrifice that we have gained the rights that we have.
What did it feel like to stand on the stage and talk to all of those young people graduating last weekend?
It was immensely humbling, but also a great honor. And to think that over 600 graduates, baccalaureate, master's, and doctoral students, and the whole emphasis at the university on service. And they had a whole series of Race Matters during the year. But it was a wonderful experience. I couldn't have had any more hospitality extended to my friends and my siblings who accompanied me. And I'm proud to be an Ambrosian now.
Oh, Sister Barbara Moore, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Sister Barbara Moore spoke at the commencement ceremony and received an honorary doctorate from St. Ambrose University in Davenport last weekend. Talk of Iowa is produced by Sarah Bowden, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbie.